Rolling. What's happening, y'all? Andy and Zach and Summer back at it with episode 98 or 99 of the A to Z No BS Show.
We'll check when we get off this camera.
And thankfully, only one of us on this couch is gassy tonight. It's not me for once.
Yeah, she's farting up a storm over here. So that's okay. You're allowed, right? Yep.
Totally. And today we're tackling fitness misconceptions, fitness myths, common... Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Summer has some common newbie questions because she's only just started her training.
Yes. She's lifting her head up and looking around. I mean, look at this.
That's pretty good.
Lifting her head up, looking around, eating fingers, playing with toes. We've discovered toes this week.
Okay.
So, yeah, tackling some fitness misconceptions like protein needs, protein timing, you know, the fat burning zone on cardio equipment, you know, lactic acid, what is it, what is it not, stuff like that. So, just trying to help everybody get a better grasp of their fitness journey.
Yeah.
Because knowledge is power.
Protein power. Is that the name of a protein drink?
Yeah, if it is, I haven't bought it. But
knowledge is power. Protein is power. You bring them together, you're an unstoppable machine. So, protein needs, or specifically, the whole protein after a workout.
The anabolic window.
The anabolic window. That's been something that I think, like many points in the industry, has some good reasoning and science to it, but is wildly overblown.
Right.
Wildly overblown.
So the basic premise being, you know, you hit a hard workout and the most critical time of day to eat a protein source is within 30 minutes of finishing your workout. So whether you've been this person or you've seen these people at the gym who have like their protein shake like on the ready, as soon as they finish their last set, they're adding water or oat milk or whatever and shaking that thing up and trying to smash a protein shake post-workout, lest all the work they just did be left on the table.
All for naught.
All for naught. And, you know, and this is why I like either reading the research or having people who are smarter than me read the research and distill it down. But we're finding that that's not necessarily the case and that, you know, your protein needs are satiated. Oh, look at me looking. Satiated over the course of the entire day. So in other words,
right,
whether you eat a high protein source like right after your workout or 3 hours after your workout is largely irrelevant so long as you're meeting, you know, protein requirements for being physically active. We can also talk about that one too, like how much protein. But for now, that anabolic window is what we're sticking to. So if it's convenient for you to have a protein shake, or, you know, if you're going home right after a workout to eat dinner, then sure. Like, why not? But if it's not convenient to carry around a shaker bottle with protein, or if you forget it at home, which is something I do all the time, it's not a big deal.
Right.
We used to think it was. Now we know that whatever your protein profile over the course of the day looks like is more important. So,
right. Yeah, and I would even say if there's any major point to be had about timing, if anything, you would probably want to get at least a good amount of protein in your last meal of the day, because that's obviously going to be your last bit of nutrition before ideally 8 to 9 hours of sleep.
Right.
So it would seem like if you really are worried about protein timing, if anything, making sure that you get in a bunch before you go to bed is one. And then also, calorie cycling for some folks is, you know, a nutritional strategy that some people like. You know, having more calories on one day, less calories on another in order to, you know, find like a net calorie deficit, you know, week over week. But one might say, okay, you have more calories on the day that you work out and you have less on your rest day.
Mm-hmm.
I would even say that that would be backwards.
Mm.
To have, I mean, obviously you want to, you know, eat enough to fuel your workout and to, you know, not starve yourself on a training day, but you're going to want those nutrients, you're going to want that protein on your rest day when your body is actually recovering, when your body is actually taking in those nutrients.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why it's probably important. So conversely, what I'm finding with my own fat loss is that the closer my weekends are in terms of like what I eat and how I'm active, the closer my weekends mimic my weekdays, the easier it is for my fat loss goal to be achieved. In other words, instead of, you know, closing out Friday at, you know, down 3 or 4 pounds from when I first started, and then starting Monday morning right back at square one, at, you know, I started at like 190, 191. And the other day at my lowest, I was at like 186.8, I think, or 186.2. If I cruise through the weekend and don't pay attention to what I'm doing and what I'm eating, then Monday morning I'm 190. Mm. And it takes all week to get back down to 186.
Right.
So depending on your goal and what you're trying to achieve, I almost think it's just, it's not easier. It's probably more practical to try to maintain a fairly boring and fairly similar or predictable calorie, protein, carbs, fat profile 7 days a week instead of cheat days and all that shit.
Yeah, I think really, no matter if your goal is hypertrophy or fat loss, I think that idea remains the same, mm-hmm. is just to be consistent.
Right. The big C word.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think, you know, for, you know, again, like for muscle building, there's always some amount of protein, rebuilding, restructuring. There's always tissue being broken down in the body, and with the right nutrients and with the right training, tissues being built up.
Mm.
Like it's like a city, right? There's always old buildings being torn down, new buildings being brought up. Now, depending on what city you're in, what, you know, quote unquote, what state your body's in, that relative ratio of destruction to construction is going to be different. But that's, again, that's why consistency is so important. You're just giving your body that same stimulus,
mm-hmm.
every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously what the body responds to, is consistency. And psychologically, right, Summer? Psychologically, that's the simplest and easiest thing for you to commit to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not fun to tell people, like, hey, you should probably eat the same things on the weekends if you're trying to lose fat. Like, you should probably eat those boring meals, but it's true. And yeah. I'm learning that and I'm pretty active, and I own a gym, and I'm very active at my work. My window of mess around is pretty narrow still.
Right.
I can't really get after it on the weekends like I wish that I could.
Your wiggle room.
My wiggle room is very narrow. So, anyway.
Yeah. Your wiggle room is quite literally being taken up by a new wiggly
human being.
Human.
She is wiggly today. Like, this is like new territory wiggly. Yeah, so we used to think that, or we used to, and I've done this, prescribed, you know, 1 gram per pound of body weight as like, that's how much protein you should aim to eat in a given day. Now, I'll admit, I've tried this, and I've tried it, and I've prescribed it. So I've been there, and it is really hard. Have you ever tried to eat, like, I don't know how much, 160, 165?
We'll say 160.
160 grams of protein a day without using, like, a bunch of protein shakes to do it is really tough.
It's a lot. Yeah.
So 185 for me. I have a client, 220, Robbie Edwards.
Sure.
He's in the 220s, and he was like, I got to eat 220 grams. I was like, you can try, but, like, it's really hard. So instead, what we're finding is that while it's a decent number and it's easy, right, to be like, oh, how much do you weigh? Try to get that many grams of protein. it's a little bit on the higher side for most people most of the time. Now, if you're, and I'm going to say, I'm going to use the word athlete, and I'm going to mean it. If you're an athlete or a physique competitor, and you're really trying to cut, like get cut, then I think the higher side, like 1 gram per pound of body weight, is probably a good number to be at. But what we're finding is that for most people, most of the time, anywhere between 0.6 on the low side and like one, I think on the high side, I think you can eat up to like 2 or 3 grams per pound of body. I don't know how you would do it or why, but you can eat that and like not have deleterious effects. All that to say, between 0.6 and 0.1 is the general needs, 0.6 to 1.0 grams per pound of body weight is a general recommendation for most people. I now, for most of my gym pop clients, I'll kind of start them on the 0.6 to point. I personally try to set mine about 0.8.
Right.
And that's been way easier. And here's the beauty of setting your protein needs lower than you think, is it gives you room for other stuff, like carbs. And when you work out really, really hard, if you try to work out really, really hard without eating carbs ever,
it's not fun.
It's not fun. And they're not good workouts. They're pretty trash workouts. But yeah, like I can eat more carbs now and still be in my calorie goal for the day. And my workouts don't suck. I can actually like push harder. And I think that's, there's something to be said, said for that. If you have the energy behind the workout and it's not a slog, you're probably going to be burning more calories. And you're probably going to be wanting to be more active outside of just a workout. Like, going for walks,
right?
Or, you know, fidget more or whatever. You have more energy to burn. So all that is to say, protein requirements, we used to say 1.0. I think for most people, most of the time, about 0.7 is good. And then a lot more calories towards carbs and rip, and you'll probably be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think really, I think just anecdotally, 100 grams seems to be like a, for a lot of people, challenging but doable sweet spot.
Right.
You know, and if you're, obviously if you're on the lighter side, 100 might be more than plenty, more than enough, more than optimal. And if you're like, you know, again, maybe 200 pounds or even more, well, 100 is probably gonna be like, well, like at least what you're gonna be needing to bring in. But for the sake of ease, 100 seems to be a pretty good line in the sand where if you're getting that, almost no matter who you are, you're probably doing pretty good. And right. Then you could kind of, you know, add context to that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's very illuminating for anyone to at least track your protein intake for a certain amount of time.
Sure.
You know, you may or may not, you know, want to really nerd out and do calories and all your macros, but protein is pretty easy to track.
Right.
You know, if you had to track one thing, I think protein would be the easiest and probably be the most illuminating.
Right. Well, yeah. I think it's always illuminating is to track your calories altogether, but I like that. I think I've never used that that marker, like 100 grams, but that, as far as like being task oriented, 100 grams is great. Yep. And then you don't have to whip out the calculator and be like, well, 0.7 of 100 and some odd pound, like just 100 grams. That's all, yeah. That's all I want you to try to do for a week is just try to get 100 grams of protein. If you can, mostly from, you know, animal protein or milk protein sources and not from like powder. I don't know. I don't mind protein powder. I just don't try to eat it more than twice a day.
Yeah, depending on your protein source, your whey protein source, you can get a little gassy.
Right.
Yeah, you know.
Well, and I eat chicken with lunch every day, and I usually eat a meat at dinner. And even with just chicken and meat at dinner and protein in my oatmeal in the morning and protein shake, I'm just getting my numbers, like just right. Getting them. So unless you're eating meat at every meal or eat like, and even eggs, like I love eggs, but they're not, and they're really expensive right now. Apparently I haven't been buying eggs, but
yep.
eggs aren't a really great protein source.
Right.
Like, two eggs is what, like 12 grams of protein, maybe?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's around 6 or 8 grams per egg.
Yeah.
So even if you have three, you know, it's not bad, but you still get a lot of that tag-along fat if you're being overall calorie conscious.
Yeah.
So,
you know what my favorite new protein snack is?
What's that?
Those Sunkist flavored tuna packs.
Mm.
You seen those? There's like a jalapeno flavor, like
jalapeno,
a lemon pepper.
Barbecue.
They're all around 100 calories and around 14 to 20 grams of protein.
Yep.
Pretty good. Not the most stout protein source of all time, but for something that's pretty low calorie and tastes pretty good.
Yeah.
And packs well.
Yep.
I mean, you need a fork, but like you can throw those in a backpack. You can throw those in a purse. You know, I keep them at the house. So instead of smashing into another whey protein shake, I just rip open a packet of tuna.
Yeah. I typically keep 5 or 6 of those on hand.
Yeah. They're great.
The Chomp beef jerkies are pretty darn good.
You know what they should do? That flavored tuna that we're talking about?
Mm.
They should do that flavored tuna, but put it in a Go-Gurt vessel. So you don't need a fork.
Mm.
Hold on, everybody. I get a snack of my tuna. You just like rip open a tube and squeeze tuna.
Squeeze it out. Squeeze it out.
Just like
a little Duke's mayonnaise in there.
Just a little tube of tuna into the mouth. Yeah, why not? We should experiment with this. And see if this is a viable. We should take
tuna
this
king.
To yeah.
Call you the tuna king.
And we'll take this to Shark Tank and be like, haven't you ever wanted tuna on the go and you don't have a fork?
Mmm.
All right. Before we get too off track, all right, so I think we've thoroughly covered protein needs and timing.
Think so.
Not such a big deal. Everybody relax. You don't have to smash your protein source post-workout. You're going to be fine.
Soreness.
Oh, delay. The soreness you feel after a workout.
Yeah, soreness, DOMS. It's been a kind of a recent, I don't know if you call it fad. I think a lot of strength coaches like to be kind of like sticks in the mud in a certain kind of way. And you've heard a lot of people in recent years, a lot of well-meaning strength coaches, I think a lot of folks in like the quote-unquote evidence-based community say that, avoid soreness or soreness is not necessary for like progress and all this stuff. And there's been a big push against people chasing soreness, which I think at the heart of it is a good thing. Like you don't necessarily want to go out of your way just to make yourself sore. You know, there's people who are into it. But obviously getting overly sore is a big point that I think keeps a lot of people from starting a lifting habit. You know, it's like, oh, I don't want to get super sore. I went to the gym once last year and I could barely sit down, that whole thing.
Yeah.
So in the interest of like, again, creating more bridges and fewer barriers to fitness, soreness doesn't necessarily have to be part of doesn't have to be a regular part of your fitness journey, so to speak.
Right.
But let's be honest, if you're working hard, you're gonna get sore.
Mm.
If you're getting stronger, you're probably gonna be sore. Not overly sore, but I would say over 10, 12, 13 years consistently working out, we still get sore.
Right.
There's almost always something on me that's at least a little bit sore.
You know, I think we have to look at this from how much is too much soreness? Because it's not like you are or are not sore. Like, or your tolerance for soreness is probably different.
Right.
Like, for example, like people have different tolerances for pain. So your tolerance for certain levels of soreness is this or that. The only time I caution my, especially like this new client that I just scheduled for tomorrow. If you're new to lifting, you're going to be, I don't know what I can do to not make you sore. But if this is your first time lifting weights in a long time or ever, you're going to be sore. Like there's not much I can do about that. It's just, it's part of the game. My hope though is to push hard enough to make adaptations or to force adaptations, but not be so sore that your daily life outside of the gym is affected adversely.
Right.
And here's why. A, people's lives exist outside of my tiny little universe of AVSC. And I have to remember that. Like, I live here in this building. They don't. Their universe, their world is not this room. So I have to, you know, they have stuff they got to do. They got places they got to be. I want to push them and work them, but I don't want to be so sore that the next day they're like moving funny or can't sit on the toilet or whatever. Like, and also, sidebar, that's a really easy workout to write. You and I both know making people sore is super easy. Like,
well, especially people who are untrained.
Right.
Just a couple of squats.
Dude, if you want me to make you sore, I got it. That's like that day Robbie was saying, he's like, oh, you know, I don't know if you push me all that hard. And I was like, buddy, there is no governor on this gas pedal. I will hammer on it. And I did. I hammered on him and Marcus. And I think they both felt the brunt of it. And I was like, but like, I didn't do it. I didn't go out of my way to like hurt them, but I pushed them really hard, probably harder than I've pushed anybody in a long time. And they were both really, really sore. They loved it, whatever. My caution only is you've been terribly sore before, right?
Oh, yeah.
Your day is affected. I put it this way. On a day when you're really sore, like super duper sore, how much movement are you getting?
Oh, considerably less.
Right. Right. So that's kind of the dance, right? Because on the one hand, I'm like, well, I want to push a client hard, but if it means that tomorrow they're going to spend more time on the couch, I don't know if I'm necessarily doing them any favors.
Right.
So.
And we're violating this principle of consistency,
mm-hmm.
going right back to what we were talking about earlier. So, yeah, you'll ride this roller coaster. You've got to be smart enough or exercise enough restraint so that even when you know that you could do a lot more, you dial yourself back and you live to fight another day. And soreness is a component of that, you know, conversation. Again, especially when you're either brand new or like even taking like myself for example, in this training phase where I'm doing a lot more running, getting ready for the half marathon for my hikes, I'm actually doing far less squatting, less specifically back squatting, because the recovery that my legs need, I don't want to compromise that by also trying to like push big squat numbers.
Right.
You know, there's just that trade-off there.
Keep the goal the goal.
Keep the goal the goal. And it's not like I don't have strong, decently strong legs.
Right.
Now, as we all know, you take even a couple weeks, much less speaking about a couple months off real squatting. You go back, I know that first workout back is going to be rough the day after in terms of soreness.
Right. The nice thing about that, though, is you can recover that squat pretty well, pretty easily, because you trained it before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you read that New York Times article?
Mm-mm.
There was a New York Times article recently that was like, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. But how long does it take to recover it? Like, let's say you take time off. How long does it take to recover lost ground? Turns out that I've always had a hunch about, like, cardio versus strength training, how long it takes to lose it and how long it takes to recover it. Turns out that cardiovascular adaptations are lost much faster, like 2 weeks. Like, if you're running consistently and then you take 2 weeks off, you're going to lose a lot of ground pretty damn quick. But the recovery of, and if I remember right, the recovery of it took a lot longer. Strength training, on the other hand, took 8 weeks to lose ground, like considerable ground. in both cases, if you come back to activity, where like wherever you're trying to get to, it takes about half as much time to get half as much progress back, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
In other words, and you and I've talked about this before.
It comes back.
It comes back quick. Now, whether that's like, my best guess with the strength training has more to do with neuromuscular adaptations. In other words, as you get stronger and stronger and stronger, your body, your brain learns how to turn on the muscle groups it needs. Not just the muscle groups, but more and more of those muscle fibers to fire and do their job. Higher threshold muscle fibers being the last to really kick in or to be the ones that we're using for super heavy work. But but training in of itself, you know, you and I know these like 6 to 8 week newbie gains. Training is literally just wiring your body to know how to find those muscle fibers and to fire them efficiently and quickly and innervate more of them, so on and so forth. My best guess with strength training is that that relearning of those neural pathways is much faster. And that's why strength gains are faster coming back. Mm,
sure.
It's not, because otherwise it's you would atrophy. If you took 8 weeks off, your muscles are going to atrophy. So it's not like there's something in the muscle tissue necessarily that's hanging on.
Yeah.
I think it's the neuromuscular adaptations that your brain is faster, more efficient at finding those pathways again.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
And you and I have talked about this actually when right before I had shoulder surgery in 2018, I had spent 8 months trying to build my squat, bench, dead, and overhead press. Now, after shoulder surgery, I dropped at least my bench and my overhead press because I didn't want to take the risk. But my squat more specifically, I recovered the ground I had lost in. It took me 8 months to get to where I wanted to be. It took me 4 months the second time.
Right.
So
yeah,
there's a lot, and I've told my clients this before and after reading this article. There's a reason that I harp on the strength training stuff so much, because even though it takes the longest to get it, to build the muscle, to build the strength, it takes the longest to lose it.
And relatively easy to maintain.
Right. To your point with the marathon training or half marathon.
Yeah.
You could probably get away with 3 working sets of squats in a week and be fine.
Yeah.
Like that minimum effective dose.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, I'm not as well versed on cardiovascular training, but yeah, I mean, anecdotally, we see this a lot. Your cardio is quickest to build, also quickest to lose. I would also be curious on the lasting effect, so to speak, of like cardio endurance. Because if we know that like strength sticks around, I mm-hmm. wonder how closely that tracks with cardiovascular progress. I don't exactly know how that would track. My guess is that it does, but probably not to the same degree that strength training does.
My best guess with cardiovascular training at the muscle tissue level there's a number of different factors that factor into like your VO2 max, for example, like how much oxygen you take in, how much oxygen you offload at the muscle tissue, how much carbon dioxide you remove from the muscle tissue, you know, mitochondrial density, you know, your heart rate, your ejection fraction, which is a fancy way of saying how much blood shoots out of your left ventricle with every beat. There's a number of different factors that go into that I imagine all play a role in that detraining.
Right.
So at the muscle cellular level and at the heart level, there's a number of different things that can detrain.
Right.
And as far as like muscle innervation, like we both know, like slow twitch muscle fibers are like the easiest and quickest to fire. That's what we're using to like walk around all the time.
Right.
So like, but to tap into those higher threshold takes a lot of effort. I don't know. I'm not in graduate school anymore.
I was going to say, how long do those brain gains from graduate school stick around?
Well, I do try to break a mental sweat on occasion.
Okay.
But going back to the whole, the soreness thing. So I think there's two prongs to this soreness thing. The first being, is soreness a good indicator of a good workout? And you and I would agree that no, not necessarily. But if you're never sore, then you're probably not working hard enough. So like a little bit of soreness is probably, on occasion, a good thing. But overall, if you're like trying to like drag yourself through the doorway every morning after a hard workout, that's probably not a place to be. The other prong is, what exactly is that soreness? A lot of people are like, all that lactic acid. And this is just me nerding out about the physiology. It's not lactic acid. Lactic acid is produced during anaerobic muscle contraction, so lifting weights. But your body clears it almost immediately. So you produce it, your body clears it. You produce it, and your body clears it. That soreness that you're feeling the next day or two after a workout is delayed onset muscle soreness, or just basically tears in the muscle fiber. So eat your protein, build up those muscle tissues.
Build up those muscles.
Uh-huh.
What's the role of those hydrogen ions?
So when you're doing, like, let's say you're doing a high rep set of, like, of dumbbell bench, right? And you start feeling that pump, start feeling that burn.
The burn. That's the spare hydrogen.
That's the hydrogen ion. Okay. So we call it lactic acid. Technically what it is lactate and hydrogen ions. Hydrogen ions are a positively charged molecule. It starts turning your blood pH more acidic. So that's why we get the acid part. When you drop those dumbbells after a heavy set, so you start feeling that burn. You drop those dumbbells, you start feeling that burn go away. You probably also notice that you might be hyperventilating a little bit, like.
I have noticed that.
That heavy breathing introduces a negatively charged ion called bicarbonate. And bicarbonate buffers the hydrogen ions and restabilizes your blood pH. In other words, your body likes homeostasis. Training is literally the application of stress to an otherwise homeostatic environment. And so your body will do everything it can to try to maintain or reestablish homeostasis. A well-trained individual just happens to have a different homeostasis than a detrained individual.
Brother, I think we're offering a free graduate level...
I mean, basically.
...class here.
I do laugh sometimes when a client is in the gym and like, oh, that was really hard, or that really hurt. And I'm like, that's just weakness leaving the body. And I was like, I got a master's degree that taught me that.
Oh, God. I got a master's degree that taught me that. That's perfect.
There was a whole chapter on pain is just weakness leaving the body. The first subheading, have you tried being strong?
That's where you got it.
Yeah.
That's that quality UT schooling over
right there. That's right.
Okay.
So.
No shame in that.
So if you've ever wondered like what the burn feels like, what it is, or what the soreness is or is not, it's not lactic acid. You think that's oxygen you're breathing right now? I think Neo. That
Matrix.
The Matrix. Matrix. You think that's oxygen you're breathing right now?
Yeah.
I think about that. I'm like, you think that's lactic acid right now?
Andy comes in the gym. Take the red pill. Take the red lifting pill.
Yeah.
Come with me if you want to lift.
Yeah. So
now I'm mixing metaphors. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Then I thought of my Arnold Schwarzenegger picture on the wall at the gym. All right. Anyway, misconceptions. We've covered protein. We've covered soreness. There's another one I texted you, and I can't remember what it was. We should tackle flexibility.
Let's tackle flexibility. I was hoping you would bring that up.
All
because
right. How much time we got on this?
We've got a few minutes.
Oh, man. We should tackle this flexibility.
Because you really had your viral moment on Instagram.
Well,
last
I had my
week.
Viral moment, but I also had a nail in the coffin for stretching again.
I laughed out loud when Dan John brought you up to demonstrate his flexibility hack. Because I was like, of all the people in the room,
it would be me.
He called you, and you're the one who's always talking trash
about stretching. What was funny about that, too, is I was taking notes. It was a great lecture, and I was taking notes on my phone, and I just happened to catch who here thinks they have tight hamstrings? And I raised my hand, and he called on me, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
We so hacked my flexibility in, what, 10 seconds?
So for those who didn't see the Instagram reel.
Which you can find on your Instagram and mine, right?
Mm-hmm. Shout out to John Harris for capturing the moment on camera. Dan John brought you up. This is at Liftapalooza the other weekend. And he told you to do a toe touch. You got to...
About 6 inches away from
about mid-shin-ish.
Yeah.
In your toe touch. Just went up there cold. And then he had you make fists, put them between your knees, and squeeze your knees tight. So essentially doing a isometric adduction of the adductors.
Right.
Had you stand up and immediately go back and test your toe touch, and you basically went...
I think it got all the way around my toes.
Yeah, you probably could have done palms to the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very easily.
Yeah.
Our little corner of the fitness industry is full of central nervous system hacks, you know, for lack of a better term. Sure. There's all these little things that we can do. But the way that I put it, the way that I interpret it is, in general, when the body knows that it's more stable or more strong, your nervous system unlocks or gives you more range of motion.
Right.
So that's a very, I think, kind of blatant and obvious example.
Well, what I love about this, you can test this. You can do the, what did he call it?
So squeezing your knees together, Utah birth control.
Utah birth control, okay. So that's what he called
it. A little dig at the Mormons there.
Right. So effectively what I was doing, was squeezing really hard. I'm not stretching my hamstrings, right? I'm not actually actively trying to stretch my hamstrings. I'm just squeezing my fists between my knees as hard as I can for 10 seconds. Which is shorter than what most people
not even.
Yeah. Shorter than what most people do, like a hamstring stretch, and automatically gain 6 inches of range of motion. So to your point, we air quotes hacked my central nervous system to believe that I was more stable and safer than I was previously, and I gained range of motion. So I rail against spending time stretching because I think it can be gained a lot easier than people give credit.
Did you like my caption?
What did it say?
It was...
Oh, right. It was like strength.
Strength greater than stability, greater than mobility, greater than flexibility.
Right. No, I did like that. I have friends and I have clients that will swear up and down that I am talking mad shit about their mom when I rail against stretching. And I've never done one as simple as the Dan John one, but I have done a kettlebell goblet squat with the lowering.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what I explain is when you do a goblet squat, your hamstring length does not change. It's the reason I pick a squat over like an RDL or whatever, a loaded hamstring stretch. Mm. I use a squat because between knee flexion and hip flexion,
the hamstring doesn't change
length. Hamstring doesn't change length.
There's another nerdy lesson for you.
Right.
For those who are paying attention and taking notes.
Right. So if you feel your hamstrings when you're squatting, it's probably more inner thigh. But anyway, so I use a goblet squat and I do like one or two or three goblet squats, maybe a couple with lowering. And then I retest and I demonstrate that my hamstring flexibility has improved. Again, goes back to the central nervous system thinks that I'm not safe. I trick it into believing that it's safe, and all of a sudden I have greater hamstring flexibility, and it took a lot less time than a whole stretching session. Now, annoyingly, this is the part where I have to be like, but if you enjoy stretching, you can do it. But honestly, if you really want my professional opinion, should I do stretching? A, no, not ever. B, if you must, as little as possible. And see, if you're going to do it, don't do it first. Don't do it in the middle. Do it at the very end of a workout at best. Oh, to continue this, I have clients. I've had friends. Well, shouldn't I stretch to prevent injury? No. Turns out that stretching doesn't prevent injury. There have been a ton of studies on stretching interventions pre-workout, and injury incidence is the same. Now, if you like stretching, what's the harm? Here's the harm. I get to see my clients, what, 2 hours a week at best, two 60-minute sessions if they're on time, and if we're moving, 120 minutes. I am not going to spend a single one of those minutes on stretching anything. I'm going to find a loaded something that will help take them through full range of motion and also burn calories and also build muscle and be a great use of our time. I am not going to stretch.
You heard it here first and last, folks. No. Please don't lob your...
Don't come at... Don't at me. Do not.
Well, listen, don't at me. You've put yourself out there on the internet.
Okay.
I will say... I'm just joking. But I will say that I agree wholeheartedly. I'm a little bit less of a... I'm just not a hater on really anything in general. So I'm not even going to say that I'm a stretching hater, even though I agree with everything that you said. I do think that there is a time and a place for stretching, for what we're doing as strength coaches in the context of a training session. I think you're right. I think there's practically no place for it.
Right.
I do think that stretching has its benefits, but speaking to the real elephant in the room, more knowledge is more power, right? So I think there's probably a lot of people who, just because they don't know any better, they've never been exposed to any other idea other than stretching is what you need to make you flexible. Something like what we're talking about might come off from left field and not land, not make any sense.
Mm.
But that also opens up the conversation of knowing well, or at least having some sort of perspective for what, like, how much flexibility you really need, how much range of motion you really need, how much do you need, how much do you want? More isn't always better.
Right.
You know?
Well, this is a very simple test, right? And I do this with people who tell me, they're like, oh, I feel my hips are tight. I need to stretch my hips because I can't get deep in my squat. So what I do is I have them do like an air squat or maybe a light goblet squat and just kind of see where they end up. And then I put them on the Hatfield apparatus at my gym or put them against that pole, have them hang onto that pole and do a squat. And all of a sudden their hips go all the way down to the ground. So clearly they don't lack flexibility or mobility. They've got it, if put in the right situation to exploit it. So is stretching and mobility work a complete waste of time? Probably not. If your time is incredibly valuable and you have very little of it to devote to fitness in a week, she's awake. We had a nice little nap there for a minute. Then I'm gonna find the tools that allow us to explore full range of motion and it'd be a good use of your time. Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about this a dozen times about like whether it's a supplement or air quotes life hack or whatever. Same with supplements. Like, well, if there's no harm, then like BCAAs. If there's no harm, then what does it matter? And I'm like, well, it costs money. BCAA supplements cost money. That's a real harm if it doesn't do anything good for you. So if you have limited time and other resources to devote to fitness every week, very limited, stretching is way on down the list.
Yep.
If you come to me 7 days a week, probably. I don't know. I'll probably work some stretching in there somewhere.
What else are you going to do?
After
you do everything else.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Absolutely. Passive stretching is pretty far down the list.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what a great hamstring stretch is?
Deadlift.
Deadlift or an RDL.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever felt how your hamstrings feel after like set two, set three, set four of an RDL.
Set four. Who do you think you're talking to?
I'm talking about ramp sets, including ramp sets.
Yeah.
Feels pretty good. All of a sudden you're like, whoa, I could probably touch my toes right now. And all I've been doing is a little loaded RDL.
Stretching with a barbell.
Yeah.
Isn't that all we're doing?
Yeah.
It's all about your perspective.
Yeah.
It's all about your perspective. But yeah, passive stretching has very limited practical application.
Right. Well, and going back to the use it or lose it, this happens with yoga people. Yoga people are very happy to show you how flexible they are because they do yoga. They practice yoga all the time. So they practice these poses and they stretch and they look how flexible I am. Have them stop doing yoga altogether. You're not allowed to do it on your own. You can't go to class. You can't stretch at all. Don't stretch for 2 weeks and have them show you how flexible they are.
All right, man. Good stuff.
It is good stuff. I'm glad that she relaxed a little bit.
Yeah.
You'll probably hear her breathing on my mic. She's really cute right now, though.
The cutest. Snuggled right into the into side the of your neck there. Perfect. Natural fit.
Mm-hmm.
All right, buddy. Good work.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else to wrap up on? We've poked a few sacred cows. We've given people some high highfalutin knowledge.
In fairness, if you want to at me, you can at me, but I'm going to die on that hill. If you like stretching, go ahead and stretch, but don't do it on my time.
Look, like the reel, subscribe.
Yeah.
Subscribe to the show.
And also, I feel like just, I'm going to pause for a second. In general, it's probably a good idea to not be really emotionally connected to anything in fitness.
Agreed.
You know, it's like people who like swear by the barbell back squat. Like, okay, fine. If you want a barbell back squat. But there's a lot of squat variations out there. I'm poly when it comes to...
You're ethically non-monogamous when it comes to exercises.
That's right. I implore people to be non-monogamous when it comes to their fitness proclivities.
Right.
Right? She's fixated on your light again all of a sudden.
I was going to say, you have enough emotional investment in your actual family. You don't need to bring it into the gym.
Mm-hmm.
And that does it from us. A to Z, no BS. We will see you next time.
Bye.